Now I'd like to introduce the moderator and the speaker this morning, if they would come on up here. From our staff, Dr. Mick Warner will be the moderator for Dr. Mark Edwards. And we paired them off together because while one is the professor at Purdue University, Dr. Mick Warner, Michael Warner from our staff, received his doctorate from Purdue University. He received it in family therapy and does a considerable amount of teaching now on our very valued teaching on our campus in counseling. I think the thing about that I should say is he did it in a remarkable time. I don't know what it was. In about while teaching here, in about a year and a half or two, I think. How he did it, I don't know. But he overcomes all handicaps, and it's just part of his nature to excel. So we're happy to have him as moderator, and he will introduce our speaker for this morning, Professor Edwards from Purdue University. We're happy to have him.
Gene, I want you to know Purdue doesn't know either. And if I tell you, they'll take it away from me. You didn't read Ron's entire note. Ron, you're also supposed to bring home a quart of milk, it says. Okay. I don't think there's anything, as Gene said earlier, that could be more felicitous than a Purdue alumnus introducing a Purdue professor, because in hobnobbing around with some of the faculty there while I was there, I became aware of how selective Purdue is and how competitive Purdue is in terms of getting the kind of people it wants to get to teach on its faculty. So if we really are known by the company we keep, I think that Dr. Edwards' professional associations also indicate something of the high quality of this man, in addition to this very impressive curriculum vitae that I have before me. I won't read the whole thing, but if you want a copy, I'll be more than glad to make a Xerox. Dr. Edwards did his undergraduate work as well as his graduate work at Stanford University. He was a member of the University of Michigan Society of Fellows in the early 70s. He taught at Wellesley College from 74 until 80 in the Department of History, and now he's a professor of history at Purdue University in West Lafayette since 1980. As I was looking over the list of Dr. Edwards' publications, I was talking with a colleague on the faculty, and I was commenting to him, you know, with such an impressive list of publications in the area of Luther and Reformation history and the Reformation Church, I wonder why in the world some synodical college or seminary didn't pick up this man and ask him to join the faculty. And although the colleague I was talking to does teach in the area of systematics, he's an eminently practical man, and he said it's probably something to do with the paycheck. But as I do look over Dr. Edwards' bibliography of books and articles and chapters and editorial and translation contributions, I would suggest that if this bibliography is anything reflective of his knowledge of Luther, probably there's only one other person who knew Luther better, and that was Katie. We would hope she would know him better anyway. And I am taking great pleasure at this time to introduce to you Dr. Mark Edwards of Purdue University, who will speak to us on the subject of Luther's last battles. Following his presentation, we will field comments and questions for a period of time. So with great pleasure, here's Dr. Edwards.
Well, I appreciate those comments. I would like to remind you, though, that this is the state of Indiana, and paychecks for professors probably compete with paychecks for seminary professors. If anything, they may compete unfavorably. It's been said by my colleagues that I specialize in the unpleasant Luther. I've written books on his fights with Protestants, and I have a book forthcoming on the polemics that he wrote in the last years of his life. I find this an interesting pursuit, however. Luther never claimed to be a saint, claimed to be a sinner like everyone else. And as a result, I think it's worthwhile taking him at his word and seeing where his sins really lie. Martin Luther was 34 years old when his 95 theses swept the German nation. He was 37 when he was excommunicated by the Roman Catholic Church. 41 when he married the former nun Katharina von Bora, and it's been pointed out that if he waited that long, he could have waited longer. And 46 when the Augsburg Confession was read to the Imperial Diet. On 10 November 1530, he turned 47, and already behind him were his breakthrough to Reformation theology, his rejection of the Roman Catholic Church, the Peasants' War, the major battles of the Sacramentarian controversy, and the submission of the Augsburg Confession. Now, I would bet that if you pick up the standard biography, or any biography in English, or for that matter, German, on Martin Luther, you will find the surprising fact that they deal almost exclusively with the events up to 1530, these events. Yet Luther did not die at the close of the Diet of Augsburg, although some, like Roland Baton, wished he had. On the contrary, after living another 15 years, a period longer than the hectic span from 1517 to 1530, he died of heart failure on 18 February 1546, 62 years old. Why are these last 15 years neglected? Well, it's not for lack of information about the older Luther. In his home in the Wittenberg Black Cloister, Luther was the center of attention and surrounded by children, students, friends, and guests. Three of his six children were born during these later years. Moreover, Luther, Katie, and their children did not live alone. I've often really felt sorry for Katie. They shared their quarters with several orphaned relatives, a varying crew of student boarders, and frequent long and short-term guests. Right after their wedding, Karlstadt showed up on the doorstep and had to be put up, for instance. At meals, various students and guests assiduously copied down all Luther's utterances, comments ranging from toilet training practices to matters of theology, preserving, therefore, a vast wealth of remarks for posterity. From these remarks and from his voluminous correspondence and from the observation of friends and guests, there emerges a picture of Luther, the older Luther, as a devoted, often tender-hearted father, a loving, teasing, and sometimes irritable husband, a man of strong friendships, and a compassionate and gifted pastor and counselor. Luther also continued his labors at the University of Wittenberg. In 1531, he presented a series of lectures on Galatians. Following this, he lectured sporadically on selected psalms, and then in 1535, he undertook to expound the book of Genesis, a labor that occupied him until 1545. He also participated in the reform of the theological faculty in 1533, and many of you know what sort of work that would represent, and the reorganization of the university curriculum in 1536. He frequently took part in disputations, which were reintroduced after a hiatus of over 10 years. In 1535, he became dean of the university, a position he held for the rest of his life. Many hours were spent in training students for the ministry, and many hours spent writing letters, placing them in parishes. He also served his university and community as pastor and as preacher. For extended periods, he substituted in the pulpit for Johann Bugenhagen, Wittenberg's pastor, who was away helping introduce the Reformation into various North German cities and territories. The later years also saw continued work on the German translation of the Bible. In 1531, Luther and his co-workers completed a revision of the Psalms. In 1532, a German edition of all the prophets. In 1533, various other books. And finally, in 1534, they issued the full German Bible. But they weren't satisfied with that. Beginning in 1539, they undertook a revision of the whole translation, which was published in 1541. And in 1544, they began to revise the Pauline letters, a revision that first appeared in 1546 after Luther's death. Now, clearly, the older Luther remained intensely involved in academic, pastoral, and familial activities. So why the neglect? Well, Luther was also very much concerned in these later years with affairs beyond Wittenberg. Through written opinions and published treatises, he participated fully in several truly bitter controversies. It is this activity, and especially his published polemics, that historians and other students of Luther find most difficult to explain and integrate into their overall view of the man. Because in some of these treatises, Luther apparently retreated from positions of principle established earlier in his career. And others, he contributed to disputes that seemed so petty and mundane as to be unworthy of a man of his religious stature. One commented that on the treatise against Hans Wurst that if a pig herder had written it, it might have been suitable, but not a shepherd of souls. And some of his later polemics were so violent and vulgar that they offended contemporaries and remain offensive to this day. For example, in the last 5 or 6 years of his life, and this is really the crucial period, Luther published breathtakingly violent attacks on Catholics, Turks, Jews, and other Protestants. By far the most notorious of these polemics are his attacks on the Jews, especially his on the Jews and their lies, and his on the ineffable name and on Christ's lineage, both of 1543. These treatises contain considerable exegesis of the Old Testament, but these exegetical passages are overshadowed by the pervasive vulgarity of Luther's language and by the incredibly harsh recommendations he offered for the treatment of contemporary Jews. He advocated, for instance, that their synagogues and schools should be burned, their homes destroyed, their books seized, their rabbis forbidden to teach, their money taken from them. They should be, he said, put to work in the fields, or better yet, expelled from Germany. Even contemporary Protestants were shocked by these writings, and they've been in the news even recently, those of you who followed the controversy over the commemorative stamp on Luther, or those of you who saw some of the discussion following the movie version of the Holocaust. Rivaling his anti-Jewish treatises for vulgarity and violence of expression is against Hans Wurst, or we might call it against Jack Sausage, of 1531. Luther's contribution to a gutter fight between Catholic Duke Heinrich of Braunschweig-Wolfenbüttel on the one side and the Protestant Landgrave Philip of Hesse and the Protestant Elector Johann Friedrich of Saxony on the other. As hard as it may seem, Luther outdid even the violence and vulgarity of against Hans Wurst in his 1545 Against the Papacy at Rome, Founded by the Devil. On the heels of these treatises, he published a series of scatological and violent woodcuts that, in most graphic terms, suggested how good Christians should treat the papacy. In these and in other treatises, Luther bestialized his opponents, most frequently likening them to pigs or asses, although other animals also came in for use. He called them liars, murderers, and hypocrites. They were all minions, all servants of the devil. He directed the devil to his ass. He renamed the papal decretals Decraptals. And Pope Paul III, whose family name was Farnese, was called Fartass, Fartsesel. And her sodomitical hellishness, Pope Paula III, who was a hermaphrodite. He also threw around words for excrement, or we should really not mince words, for shit, with great abandon. And in the woodcuts by Lucas Cranach, he commissioned at the end of his life, and he told Lucas Cranach what he wanted on these woodcuts. He had, for instance, the papal church depicted as being expelled from the anus of an enormous she-devil, and suggested once again in picture that the pope, cardinals, and bishops should be hung from gallows with their tongues nailed alongside in the same way that their seals would hang from a papal bull. I, in fact, have slides of this and thought about having audiovisual aids, and then decided that this early in the morning it probably was not a good idea. Now, not all of his later polemics were vulgar, but many had strong political overtones, and so raised the question whether perhaps religious principle was occasionally being subordinated to politics. By the late 1520s, most of the leaders of the Protestant estates were prepared to use armed force to defend their faith, even against an imperially led attack. In Warning to His Dear German People of 1531, and concerning the three hierarchies of 1539, Luther appeared to sustain the ruler's decision, even though years earlier, he had most adamantly rejected armed resistance to the emperor in defense of faith. It was a matter of faith, and he was also superior authority, duly constituted superior authority. In the 1530s, the Protestant rulers also decided to reject out of hand a papal invitation to a general council of the church, although for years they and Luther had called for a council. Although Luther himself disagreed with their decision, he agreed with their evaluation of the papal council, but disagreed with the decision to reject it, not to attend. He thought he should attend. It was a matter of faith to attend and give testimony to his beliefs. He was given the task of discrediting the council called by the Pope and justifying the Protestant refusal to participate in it. He did this. He was also given the task of justifying in print the seizure of the bishopric of Naumburg by Elector Johann Friedrich. And this is fairly clearly a political, dynastic action rather than a religious one. And he tried to talk his elector out of doing it. And then the elector went ahead and did it, and he was given the task of justifying it. And he also defended and applauded the two offenses of the Protestant League of Schmalkalden against their Catholic neighbor, Braunschweig of Wolfenbüttel. He was much criticized at the time for many of these activities and publications, and these same activities and publications have cast a shadow over the older Luther's reputation to this very day. Now, many of you are pastors or leaders in your congregation, and in this year, the 500th anniversary of Luther's birth, this issue will come up. In fact, as I've said, with the matter of the stamp or the film on the Holocaust, it already has come up. And you may be asked, what about the writings of the older Luther? What about the older Luther? Now, it's not the historian's job to save Luther's reputation on matters where he deserves censure. But the historian must insist that those who wish to dispense praise and blame first understand what they're judging. At the heart of this paper, and at the heart of the book from which it's drawn, it's just coming out right now, rests the conviction that in both popular and scholarly works, the older Luther is being judged without a full understanding of the circumstances that he faced. It is only as we enlarge our view to consider the changed character of the Reformation movement by the late 1520s, the new pressures impinging on Luther, and the severely limited alternatives that he faced, that we can fairly judge the polemics of his later years. For me, at least, to view Luther entangled within his net of time and circumstance is to transcend the need to either accuse or excuse. It's enough to approach a firmer understanding. Let's begin with some of the standard answers you get to the question, what about the older Luther, or in fact, the standard answer. It is often argued that the polemical excesses of the older Luther are attributable to his age and poor health. He was violent, abusive, vulgar, and overly verbose because he was a sick, irascible, and slightly senile old man. Some even claim that Luther was mentally ill, a manic depressive. Now, it's true that throughout his career, he was often not well. At one time or another, and often at the same time, he suffered from constipation or diarrhea, frequent headaches and dizziness, an open ulcer on his leg, which they kept open, thinking it would bleed off the humors, severe and recurring kidney stone attacks, probable arthritis, and severe angina. And these is just the major afflictions. Spasms caused by stone attack are among the most painful experiences that one can have. I don't know if there's anyone here who's experienced that. It seems unlikely that this intense pain, together with headaches, dizziness, and probable arthritis, failed to contribute to Luther's infamous irascibility. I mean, he said himself that his special sin was anger, and in this he knew himself well. His generally poor health, and especially probable arteriosclerosis, with its usual impairment of circulation, also raises the question of possible senility, or at least of reduced intellectual acuity in his later years. Finally, renal damage, with its devastating results, may have been caused by extended retention of urine during the acute stone attack in 1537. He was unable to urinate for a number of days, and afterwards, with a certain amount of exaggeration, claimed that he had urinated 3 gallons. And the discussion earlier of the medical remedies used for Luther when his final heart attack are nothing compared to what they did at the time of his stone attack. And because he was such a famous man, all this was public. So you can imagine, you can't urinate, and there are all these people standing around with help and suggestions. And we have the records of the money spent for various instruments used to try to dislodge the kidney stone. And you can imagine these attempts as public. In fact, in mixed company, I won't mention some of all the things that were attempted. Now, each of these conditions, of course, may have exacerbated the other. Now, that Luther suffered from severe illness, and also he also definitely suffered from depression, it cannot be denied. That he was mentally ill, however, a manic depressive, is another matter altogether, and it's been hotly disputed. I just don't think the evidence warrants that. In fact, I'm sure the evidence doesn't warrant that conclusion. Now, although it seems highly unlikely that illness played no role in shaping some of the later polemics, it is, as we shall see in a moment, difficult, extremely difficult, to discern a pattern of influence. Much of what follows, which is abridged from my consideration in the book, is based on the assumption if you're ill, there should be some relationship between the illnesses and the acuteness of the illnesses and various other things that are going on in your life. And you'll see in a moment that's not the case. Luther's repeated complaint that his illnesses kept him from his work suggests at least one way to test for the effects of illness and age. How productive was Luther during these later years? This is not actually an easy question to answer, for there are many confounding factors, but statistics on publications are suggestive. To begin with, it must be remembered that by almost any standard, Luther was enormously productive throughout his life. He, as a university professor, publisher, parish, was no problem for Martin Luther. In 1531, he was sick for 6 months and still produced 180 sermons, wrote at least 100 letters and 15 treatises, lectured twice or three times a week on Galatians, and worked on his translation of the Old Testament. You wonder what he would do if he were well. And in 1537, when he suffered his most severe and debilitating stone attack, the one he almost died from, he preached some 90 sermons, he lectured, he wrote at least 55 letters, and produced some 25 treatises. It was at this point that he complained vociferously that he was so ill and his head was bothering him so much that he could not write any letters. Of course, this complaint appeared repeatedly in his letters. Many of the treatises of this year were written during his convalescence from the stone attack. By themselves, of course, these statistics represent truly remarkable productivity. It's only when you compare these to his earlier years that you might conclude that, in fact, illness and age were having some effect. Because if attention is paid to 1530 as a plausible dividing line between the younger and the older Luther, 1530, 47 years old, it is seen that 2/3 of his first editions, that is, original works, issued from the press during the period 1516 to 1530. In the remaining 15 years of his life, the period 1531 to 1546, Luther produced the remaining third of his original works. I have a lot of statistics which I won't bore you with. Let me say that as large as this decline was, it must be understood in relation to the prodigious activity of the earlier period. Excluding Bible translations, some 360 of Luther's original works were printed in the period 1516 to 1530. The latter period saw only 184 original works. Still, of course, a staggering number by any measure. It must be stressed that the major decline in Luther's productivity came in the late 1520s, years before his most severe illnesses. 1523, in fact, witnessed the greatest number of first editions of Luther's works. The real fall off in publication did not come until after 1525. That's an important year because that's the year of the Peasants' War and the year of his marriage. Some say the end of the popular Reformation, or at least popular enthusiasm for the Reformation. The most significant decline in the first editions occurs between the period 1521-1525 and the period 1526-1530. There were 192 first editions in the earlier period and only 95 first editions in the following period. This change, however, cannot be explained by health. It's more plausible to explain it in relation to the development of the Protestant Reformation beyond Martin Luther. That is, there are more people publishing on Protestant matters, more people preaching. He's not alone anymore. The effects of the Peasants' War, which may have dampened some enthusiasm for the Reformation. And perhaps one of the most reasonable explanations is the printing press. The printing industry had overexpanded, and they were competing with each other, and they had to contract. The decline in the number of original publications during the last 15 years of Luther's life was very gradual, with no sharp discontinuity in, say, 1537, the year of the great kidney stone attack, that might point to the effects of renal failure or the onset of acute senility or manic depressive psychosis. Very gradual throughout the last years. Now, while it seems likely, then, that aging and ill health played some role in the gradual decline during the last 15 years of Luther's life, the quantitative evidence does not allow us to go beyond this bland conclusion. The evidence does not support any hypothesis positing a sharp discontinuity in the late 1530s, indicating the onset of senility or mental illness. What about a qualitative decline? It is true that his most infamous polemics, his most vulgar and violent attacks on Jews, Catholics, Protestant opponents, occurred during the last 5 or 6 years of his life. But once again, the pattern is not clear, and a precipitating cause or causes difficult to discern. Luther continued to produce lucid, well-reasoned argument and exegesis up to his death. For example, his masterwork on the Councils in the Church of 1539 was composed after 1537 and his major stone attack. And Luther continued to 1545 to lecture lucidly on Genesis. Massive and important revisions of his Bible translation also occurred during this period. And perhaps more to the point, every polemic Luther produced during these later years contained sections devoted to clear and persuasive exposition of doctrine and exegesis of Scripture. Take, for example, his Against Hans Wurst, the politically inspired treatise. It's certainly a politically inspired, done at the request of his prince, and one of the most violent and vulgar that he ever produced. Fully two-thirds of this treatise is given over to violent, uninhibited, and I must say often unedifying, attacks on Duke Heinrich and his Catholic allies. Yet, within the context of this war of words, there were over 100 publications in this quarrel. Luther's only being one out of over 100, including publications of scurrilous ditties and songs that were put to the tune of various things. I don't know whether the tune was Dionysian or Apollinarian, but they certainly reflected unfavorably on the ancestry of the Duke Heinrich. And graffiti on walls and the whole business. Well, in any case, within the context of this war of words, it is remarkable, his treatise is remarkable only for the greater eloquence of his insults. That is, when Luther insulted you, you were insulted. The princes, in comparison, were very wooden. I mean, they were very. After a while, I was glad to get back to Luther. And it's also remarkable for the injection of some theological consideration into what otherwise was a secular matter. And finally, sandwiched between the invective and abuse is a lucid discussion of the characteristics of the true and the false church, and a briefer comment on the distinction between person and office. The independent worth of this section on the true and the false church was attested to by its later publication in combination with the Schmalkaldic articles. Even Luther's notorious vulgarity and violence of expression shows no clear pattern that demonstrates the influence of mental or physical illness. Throughout his later years, Luther produced both violent and temperate polemics. To take again the example of his attacks on Duke Heinrich Braunschweig-Wolfenbüttel, his violent and abusive against Hans Wurst was followed 4 years later by a very moderate to the Elector of Saxony and Landgraf of Hesse concerning the captured Heinrich of Braunschweig. They had captured him, and the question was Landgraf Philip going to let him go? Luther, this prince didn't want him to, and Luther wrote to try to talk him out of it. The difference between these two treatises can be best explained not by changes in Luther's physical or mental health, but rather by changes in external circumstances. The abuse and coerciveness in conclusion found in the earlier treatise was a deliberate polemical tactic. And although it represented an escalation in the abusive rhetoric to that point, that is, if you look at about the 30 or 40 polemics before Luther's and look at Luther's, Luther has really raised the decibel level. But the ones that come after him attempt to match or surpass. In some cases, they do. And in any case, the earlier one was in keeping with the tenor of the dispute, and the later treatises, since he was seeking to convince a Protestant prince not to let Duke Heinrich go, it called for a more reasonable, sort of matter-of-fact discussion of the issue, and this is exactly what Martin Luther produced. Now, if the polemics of the older Luther cannot be adequately explained by pathology, they also cannot be fully explained by reference to Luther's Augustinian view of history or his apocalyptic expectations, although both these factors probably account for far more than do ill health. It was early in his career as a reformer that his reading of the Bible had convinced him that practically from the beginning of the world, there had been a perpetual and unchanging struggle between the true and false church. He saw this struggle as involving a recurrent contest between true and false prophets and apostles. And so, believing that mankind did not change and the devil never slept, he saw the struggles that went on in the Bible as being no different from the struggles going on in his own time. What happened to the men of God, to the prophets and the apostles in their day, could and would happen to the church of his day. Their experiences established a paradigm of the dynamics of sacred history, of all sacred history. Within this paradigm, the papacy was the Antichrist, described in Scripture. The Turks were Gog and the little horn in the book of Daniel. Contemporary Jewry was the remnant of a rejected people suffering under God's wrath. And his Protestant opponents were contemporary false prophets and apostles, no different from those that had bothered St. Paul. They were all members of the false church. He understood his disagreement with them in the context of this struggle between God and Satan. And behind them all loomed the figure of the devil, the father of lies. Luther believed in the devil in a way that I think we moderns never can quite approach. More often than not, Luther directed his polemical attack at the devil he saw behind his opponents rather than at the opponents themselves. This was very hard to reply to, since the people felt, you know, they didn't want to speak for that particular individual, and they felt that Luther was not addressing them directly. Furthermore, since Luther was often drawing comparisons and parallels between these opponents and the opponents of the true prophets and apostles, it was only natural that he would see the true prophets and apostles as having provided a precedent for the way in which one should deal with such opponents. As a result, he could explain and justify his polemics and his stubbornness on points of doctrine by pointing to the example set by these men of God. He pointed out that Paul had said that his opponents should castrate themselves, and or almost wish that they did, and he wasn't suggesting anything less or anything stronger. This view of history and of his own role in it can help explain some of the polemics of the older Luther. It can help us understand how Luther could recommend such harsh and, to us, inhumane treatment of Jews and supporters of the papacy. It was the devil himself whom he thought he was attacking. Some of Luther's language may also be attributed to this biblically based view of the struggle. When, for example, he rebuked his age for its failings, in most graphic terms, it was a prophet like Jeremiah from whom he often borrowed his style, his tone, even the language itself. And when he blasted, for instance, the papacy as a wanton whore, he was borrowing polemic from Hosea and Ezekiel. But this explanation, too, is insufficient. This view of the world and of his own role in the struggle between the true and false church develops early and is fully formed by 1531 at the latest. It cannot fully account for the peculiar polemics of the last years. In fact, his apocalyptic expectations must also be considered. That is, he thought he was living in the end time. It seems undeniable that the passion of Luther's polemics was increased by his conviction, widely shared in some form by his contemporaries, both Protestant and Catholic, that he was living in the last times. He would have been aghast and badly disappointed to think that the world would last long enough to have a 500th anniversary of his birth. The world for him was in its final old age. The end was at hand. In his writings and in his prayers, he was torn between bewailing these signs of his time and hailing them as a certain prelude to the last judgment. Once again, however, as important as his apocalyptic beliefs were for his later polemics, this apocalyptic dimension does not account for change. An apocalyptic mood suffuses nearly all of the older Luther's polemics and much of the younger Luther's polemics. Consider, for example, some of his most overtly apocalyptic writings, his treatises against the Turks. On War Against the Turks and the Army Sermon Against the Turks both appeared in 1529. His admonition to prayer against the Turks appeared in 1541, and the admonition to the pastors in the superintendency of the Church of Wittenberg appeared in 1543. In all of these writings, the true Antichrist for Luther was not the Turks, but the Pope. But the Turks were still seen as the devil incarnate, Gog, the little horn in the Book of Daniel. Turkish military successes were viewed as a prelude to the Last Judgment. The only striking difference between the earlier writings and the later ones, however, is the greater pessimism about the likelihood of imperial success against the Turks. Not only was there the intervening record of defeat after defeat to sour Luther's expectations, the Christians kept losing, there was also what he viewed as an increasing ingratitude of the Germans toward the renewed gospel and an ever-expanding worldliness and sinfulness at all social levels. This last point suggests certain personal factors that may have compounded his general apocalyptic expectations. The older Luther was severely disappointed with the course of events from the mid-1520s onward, and this disappointment may have fueled his rage against opponents and even against supporters who failed to act as Luther hoped that they would. Such disappointment is often adduced to explain how Luther could pen the tolerant and sympathetic that Jesus Christ was born a Jew in 1523. Jews were very excited by this treatise. And then display such total intolerance and make such inhumane and violent recommendations concerning the Jews in his anti-Jewish treatises of his last years. They say, well, he had expectations early on, these were disappointed, and so he turned towards harsh mercy. Luther's apocalyptic mood may also have been reinforced by his fears for the fate of the Reformation movement after his own death. These fears were shared by others. Elector Johann Friedrich commissioned the Schmalkaldic Articles partly to serve as Luther's last testament, both against the Catholics and against deviants within the Lutheran ranks. Luther himself seemed to have viewed as his last testament against these different opponents, his anti-Jewish treatises of 1543, his short confession on the supper of 1544, and his 1545 against the papacy at Rome founded by the devil, along with the associated cartoons. For example, when asked why he had published the cartoons, Luther replied that he realized that he did not have long to live, and yet he still had much which ought to be revealed about the papacy and its kingdom. For this reason, he had published the pictures, which each said a whole book's worth of what ought to be written about the papacy. For instance, one of them shows the Pope holding out a papal bull seated on his throne. There are two peasants with their trousers down, farting gigantic clouds towards the papacy, and that was worth a whole book. It was, he stated, his testament. Now, I freely concede that Luther's health, his worldview, his apocalyptic expectation, and his fears for the Reformation movement after his own demise are all significant for the understanding of his later polemics. But I would add that the external circumstances and challenges that he and his movement faced in these later years may be even more significant for our understanding of his polemics. The Peasants' War of 1525, the Visitations of 1527 and 1528, the threatening recess of the Diets of 1529 and 1530, the formation of the Protestant League of Schmalkalden in 1531 to defend the Protestants from Catholic attack. These and similar events in the late 1520s and early 1530s were both cause and effect of a transition from a revolutionary movement made up primarily of ideologically committed individuals, such as Luther, to a more conservative movement led by rulers of territories and city-states. Now, this transition was unavoidable if the Reformation was to endure. It's one thing to initiate a revolution, it's another thing to pass it on to your children and to your children's children. The former may be accomplished with belief and individual effort. The latter, sometimes unfortunately, requires institutions and bureaucracy. But these new circumstances imposed new and difficult requirements on Luther. They called for a willingness to compromise, to accommodate himself to political necessity, to take sides publicly in disputes where no great principles were at stake and where ideological conviction found itself leagued with political self-interest. Now, too great a readiness to compromise or reach accommodation would have opened him to the charge of hypocrisy and insincerity, accusations fatal to his authority. This is what happened for some with Martin Bucer and Ulrich Zwingli. On the other hand, too great a rigidity and dedication to complete consistency and purity would have deprived him of any influence over crucial events. Principles had to bend to necessity, not break. In fact, the years after 1530 saw in Luther's correspondence and his published polemics a shift that reflected the change in the character of the Reformation movement itself. A much larger percentage of his total correspondence in these later years was directed to secular authorities, to princes and city councils. A similar change occurred with his polemics. The polemics of the previous decade or so, that is of the late of the 1520s mainly, included a significant number of treatises that were directed towards the unconverted, at open-minded Catholics, and were dedicated to the exposition of Protestant faith. In contrast, the polemics of these later years in the 1530s were largely works of exhortation, not explanation, exhortation aimed at the converted, at convinced Lutherans, designed to deepen beliefs already held, and were most often politically inspired and of direct political significance. This shift in the character of his polemics and their intended audience is manifested also in the locations where the works were printed and reprinted. In contrast to the earlier years, when a number of printing centers throughout Germany and beyond, accounted for a substantial percentage of works by Luther, the later years saw most of the printings and reprintings coming from Wittenberg, supplemented by the productions of a few staunchly Lutheran cities, mostly in central and northern Germany. And you can assume that where they're being printed, that's also pretty much where they're being read, at least in many cases. Luther publication statistics suggest, and I have a lot of details that I'm skipping over, Luther had become a publicist for an established, territorially defined ideology or religious group. Of course, the greatly heightened role of politics and the accompanying shift in the character and audience of Luther's polemics came a good decade before the 1540s. For example, in the matter of armed resistance to the emperor for the sake of the gospel, Luther, under intense pressure from Landgrave Philip, from the elector, and especially from the jurists and political advisors, grudgingly allowed the Protestant estates in 1530 to adopt a positive law justification for resistance. This stance left him profoundly uncomfortable. In fact, the tension he felt seems to have spilled over into the polemics he wrote on this issue. Despite his own theological reservations, however, as a practical matter, his warning to the dear Germans encouraged Protestants to resist a Catholic attack, even if led by the emperor. He described them in such impassioned, the papists in such impassioned fashion that you just want to grab a halberd and go out there and work. With its impassioned language, abusive characterization of opponents, and almost summary discussions of the theological issues involved, this treatise and others like it were obviously intended to be a treatise of exhortation rather than explanation. It may have deepened convictions already held, in fact, I'm sure it would have, but it was